It's Tuesday, May 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, one of Iraq's largest cities comes under the control of Islamic State. The top U.S. diplomat is in Asia.
There might be foreign fighters, there might be terrorists also trying to hide, to blend in among the migrants.
Problems for migrants in Europe and Asia. Also ahead, hopes for horse racing fans to see some history. And some of music's best are recognized. It's all coming up today on International Edition from The Voice of America. Shiite militias headed to the outskirts of the Iraqi city of Ramadi Monday after Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi called for support in the aftermath of an Islamic State victory there. Those groups could be boosting security forces in a possible counteroffensive to take back the capital of Anbar province. The military and tribal forces that fled Ramadi Sunday have regrouped on the city's eastern edge in what several sources have told VOA is an attempt to block any IS advance toward Baghdad. IS fighters raised their flag over Ramadi on Friday, marking one of its most prominent territorial gains this year. To put this latest development into perspective, we're joined by Rick Brennan. He's a senior political scientist at Rand Corporation. Mr. Brennan, how does the capture of Ramadi compare to other recent Islamic State conquests in Iraq?
If you look at what happened in Tikrit just a couple months ago, the ISIS was defeated by Iraqi forces. And they were pushed out. What we saw in Ramadi, though, was a well-planned or organized operation where the governmental forces were located within a very small sector. And ISIS was able to use upwards of perhaps 15 truck bombs, followed by troops that were coming in. They weren't large numbers, but the sheer force of them coming in with the truck bombs and breaking through is what made this recent battle successful for them. But again, it's one tactical victory. I think that we need to continue to think about this as a war that's going to take a long time, and there'll be defeats as well as victories on both sides as we go along.
There have been some calls for the assistance of Shia militias that have been put out, and does that perhaps include one of arguably the most robust forces in the region, Iran's top-tier force, to help bail Baghdad out of this?
I don't believe so. I think the position the United States has taken on this has been that as long as you're talking about Shia militias, Iraqi Shia militias, working under the command and control of the Iraqi government, the United States will support it. We already saw in Tikrit that the Iranian forces, without U.S. support, did a very poor job, and it took the U.S. air power and our willingness to share intelligence and share our knowledge of operational command and control that allowed the Iraqis to succeed. The Iraqis are going to need us to take Ramadi. They're going to need us to need the United States to take the remainder of Anbar province. And so the United States is going to be watching this very carefully as we go. But it won't be Iran's Quds forces. It won't be Soleimani. And if he starts showing up in the area, I think you're going to see the backing away of U.S. support.
That was my next question about Ramadi. If it has not fallen, it certainly is at least under control and the efforts that are going to be needed to liberate it.
It's going to be significant. Ramadi is a relatively large city. You're talking about house-to-house, block-to-block fighting to retake this. It depends on the commitment of the government of Iraq. From early indications, it sounds like Prime Minister al-Abadi has determined that he's going to send in his special operations forces as well as additional federal police and the Shia militias. Combined, they'll have the capability to retake portions of this. But again, I wouldn't expect to see anything dramatic take place, either success or failure, within the near future. This is going to be an action that the Iraqi army is going to have to prepare for, and the real challenge comes with how they think about being able to conduct this operation as well as the operations they're going to have to do to conduct in the north as we're looking at the Baji oil fields and the area around Samarra, which are also under contestation.
Rick Brennan, senior political scientist at Rand Corporation, thank you for joining us. In our VOA studios right now is Michael Lippin, who's been following the reaction to developments in Iraq on social media.
Hey, Jen. Yes, that's right. Our audience has been sharing its thoughts about the fall of Ramadi on our Voice of America Facebook page. That's where you can see video of Iraqi forces fleeing the city in their vehicles as the Islamic State militants took control. Now, under the video clip, we have a series of comments, including one from Abdi Fita Mohamed Shamuk, based in the Somali capital, Mogadishu. He describes the fall of Ramadi as a great victory for ISIS. Now, that's another name for the Islamic State group. Another comment comes from Facebook user Felix R. Sanchez, who seems to blame the situation on the United States. He wrote, "Overthrow one tyrant, and then you get this mess." Now, by tyrant, he may be referring to former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, whom a U.S.-led coalition overthrew in 2003. And a third comment comes from a reader in eastern India, Abdi Sheikh Chatterjee. He thinks the U.S. should do more to help Iraqis. He says America is not serious in its campaign against the barbaric ISIS. It's more symbolic than anything else. Jim?
Michael, thanks for sharing those interesting comments. And you can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is International Edition from studios in Washington. I'm Jim Stevenson. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met Monday with South Korean President Park Geun-hye and her foreign minister in Seoul for discussions on security on the Korean Peninsula and bilateral issues. Kerry said North Korea has not even come close to taking the steps needed to rein in its nuclear weapons programs for Washington to initiate talks. Mr. Kerry arrived in South Korea from China, where he met with President Xi Jinping and Foreign Minister Wang Yi. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with co-editor Anki Panda of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication The Diplomat, who says China's reclamation efforts at five locations in the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea total about 800 hectares in the past 5 months.
And I spoke with co-editor Ankit Panda of the Asia-Pacific current affairs publication called The Diplomat, whose comments followed a Pentagon assessment that China's reclamation efforts at five locations in the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea total about 800 hectares in the past 5 months.
China has been undertaking these land reclamation activities in the South China Sea, building islands, building facilities, which is something, by the way, that other South China Sea claimant states have done in the past. The reason that we're reading so much about what China is doing is because it is doing it at a larger scale and at a faster pace than any state before it. And that's obviously causing huge concerns in the United States. China has this nine-dash line claim, which is capacious, comprising about 90% of the waters of the entire South China Sea. And it has disputes with five states and disagreements with Indonesia, of course, also, which is not actually a formal disputant. So many of these states are close to the United States. One of them, the Philippines, is an ally of the United States. So there is also the question of the United States resolve and credibility in this region. Particularly, it needs to reassure allies, it needs to show its Asian partners that the United States will stand up for principles like the freedom of navigation in Asia, especially because the Obama administration has also declared this policy of its rebalance to Asia, which is ongoing. And if the United States doesn't push China on this issue of the South China Sea, Asian states will essentially see the rebalance as a non-starter. I mean, if the United States can't stand up for basic international principles like freedom of navigation, there's little teeth to be had to this rebalance. Going back to the issue of Kerry's trip to China, the U.S.-China bilateral is, I think, at a turning point right now. President Xi is scheduled to travel to the United States in September later this year, which I think will be a major turning point. He'll meet President Obama. I think whatever comes out of that meeting will tell us about where things are going next year, maybe in the next 2 years.
Mr. Xi described bilateral relations as stable overall. What does that mean?
That the United States and China are still doing business. They're still able to talk. They're still able to exchange views, regardless of how much they disagree on issues of core importance, such as the South China Sea issue, the broader place of the United States in Asia. I think the quote that you said, where she emphasized that the Pacific is big enough for both these powers, is an important point. I think China sees it that way. The United States is intent on preserving its strategic primacy in Asia. And that's, again, a broader question. You know, there's a disagreement about, in the United States, about whether the United States can and should do that.
It's now 15 minutes past the hour. We check the day's news.
And here are the news stories we're following at this hour. Shiite militias headed to the outskirts of the Iraqi city of Ramadi on Monday in the aftermath of the Islamic State victory there. The military and tribal forces that fled Ramadi on Sunday have regrouped on the city's eastern edge in what several sources say is an attempt to block any IS advance toward Baghdad. U.S. President Barack Obama says the government will prohibit the use of some military-style equipment by local law enforcement. During a speech in Camden, New Jersey, on Monday, Mr. Obama said the equipment intimidates residents and sends a wrong message. About 170 rival motorcycle gang members remained jailed Monday in Texas following a deadly shootout and brawl at a Waco restaurant the day before. Police are investigating the incident that left 9 bikers dead and 18 injured in Waco, Texas. That's the latest news. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
Welcome back to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Faced with calls for quick action after the deaths of hundreds of migrants on the Mediterranean Sea, the European Union has agreed to set up a naval mission to crack down on smuggling rings. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, speaking after a meeting of EU foreign and defense ministers, said she hoped the new naval mission in the Mediterranean will be established by next month.
There is a clear sense of urgency in this respect, also because we all know very well that June is the beginning of summer, and in this operation, seasons are important. And as summer comes, more people are traveling, and we want to have, at least I would like to have, the operation in place as soon as possible.
The operation aims to capture and destroy smugglers' boats off the coast of Libya, and the EU is seeking authorization from the United Nations to do so. Mogherini says it also means cooperation and action on the part of Libyan authorities.
Because there is a responsibility that the European Union can take, but there is, first of all, a responsibility that the Libyans themselves have to take on their territory, on their borders, being them land borders or sea borders. So we're looking for partnership.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg attended the meeting and said extremist groups operating in Libya and elsewhere in the region are another part of the migration problem.
There might be foreign fighters, there might be terrorists also trying to hide, to blend in among the migrants.
The naval action is part of broader EU efforts to address the growing number of migrants trying to flee war and hunger in Africa and the Middle East. Nearly 50,000 migrants have crossed the Mediterranean for Europe this year. Hundreds of others have died trying to do so. The European Commission, the EU executive arm, has also announced plans to take in 20,000 more refugees over the next 2 years. But a number of countries, including Britain, France, and Poland, oppose the Commission's efforts to establish quotas for asylum seekers. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Michael Lippin rejoins us with comments on another situation involving refugees on the open water.
That's right, Jim. The plight of hundreds of migrants and refugees from Myanmar and Bangladesh who have been drifting in the Andaman Sea and the Strait of Malacca has generated strong feelings from our Facebook audience. We posted a TV report about the boat people who identify as Rohingyas on our VOA Asia Facebook page on May 16th. Now, that report by Zlatica Hoke explains why the boat people have been unable to find an Asian country willing to accept them. One of the comments under the video is from Diana Tagarian, a Thai speaker based in the U.S. city of Albuquerque, New Mexico. She says the United Nations has to urge Myanmar and Bangladesh to fix this problem. Thailand has tried to help Rohingya refugees for years, but since we now have many of our own problems and a limited budget, why doesn't the U.S. take the migrants? Well, the U.S. has not offered to do that. The U.S. State Department has said that the stranded boat people represent an urgent problem that should be addressed regionally, but also through what it calls a coordinated international effort. Jim?
All right, great. You can leave your comments with us on Facebook or at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
It's been 37 years since we've had a horse racing Triple Crown winner. USA Today sports writer Christine Brennan joins me to talk about American Pharoah, which has now won the first two races. Christine, you were in Baltimore at the Preakness, a very wet race.
Oh, I'll tell you, you know, it looked like the elements and the racing gods were against him. You know, the storm just showed up and just camped out right over Pimlico at the exact wrong moment. It's post time and the heavens have opened. It was just torrential rain and wind and lightning. And, you know, you're saying, okay, this is going to doom American Pharoah. You know, there's just no way. And, of course, it was the complete opposite. This horse was unfazed by what was bothering all the human beings at the track and evacuating people and whatever. The horses went off, and American Pharoah basically took the lead first moment he could and never gave it up. And on the backstretch where there was a cluster of horses that were right there, and you kind of thought, okay, he's going to lose it here. And he put his foot on the gas and just went, wow, you know, boom. And seven lengths victory in those kind of conditions and the mud and the slop, it was very impressive.
Well, there was only a short time, I guess, between the Kentucky Derby win and the Preakness, but now the horse will have about 3 weeks to rest and train ahead of Belmont. That would seem to give American Pharoah a pretty good shot at this.
It would. You know, the 3 weeks is another extra week. I was at the Derby. I was at the Preakness. And so let's hope that that's enough time for rest. You know, for the horse to get back into shape and be able to run the longest, course of the three legs of the Triple Crown, the Belmont Stakes. The problem, as we've seen over the past few years, California Chrome faced it last year, is all the horses who come in fresh. For example, Materiality and Carpe Diem are two of those top favorites from the Kentucky Derby who did not race at the Preakness. So they come in not with 3 weeks of rest and recuperation, but 5 weeks. And that is one of, I think, something that people have not really clued into until last year when the California Chrome, when the trainer, you know, went off on that afterwards and talked about how unfair it is that these horses basically cherry pick races, or the trainers, the owners cherry pick the races, and then fresh horses show up to beat a horse that has done everything that he had to do, which is be in both of those, the first two legs of the Triple Crown. So in some ways, to me, this strikes me as unfair. Experts in the sport will say, no, you don't want that. It could hurt horses. Okay, I understand that. We certainly don't want to be inhumane to any animal. But then what kind of competition is this when you've got a horse that, of course, like American Pharoah, now has to show up, obviously. It's the Triple Crown's on the line. This horse wins the Derby, so of course he shows up at the Preakness. And of course, then, if after winning the Preakness, he shows up at the Belmont Stakes. And yet other horses can lie in wait and be totally rested. Is this really sport? It's certainly valid asking the question, and then asking the question, will we ever see another Triple Crown winner based on this system that now rewards those horses who wait and sit out a race and then come back strong and win the Belmont over the horse that has won the Derby and the Preakness?
Christine Brennan, thank you so much for joining us. USA Today national sports columnist, also with ABC News, CNN, PBS commentator. Who don't you appear with? Thank you.
Well, I'm glad, Jim, to be appearing with you. Thank you very much.
Well, there are also annual music awards, which have been handed out. My colleague Susan Yockey has more on the winners.
Last night was a huge night for music as the Billboard Awards took center stage in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. VOA Music's Nikki Strong is here to fill us in on what went down. And Nikki, this is the first time you and I have worked together. I want to welcome you.
Thank you
so much.
Very
nice to meet you.
I appreciate it.
So what's all the hype about?
Okay, well, Taylor Swift dominated the night. The show kicked off with the premiere of her new video, Bad Blood, which depicted this cool, futuristic world of kick-butt female assassins, many of whom were fellow celebrities, so that was cool. And then from there, the night belonged to her. She took home 8 awards, including Top Artist, Top Female Artist, Top Billboard 200 Artist, and what was really cool was how she attributed much of her success to her fans.
To the fans that I talk to online and the ones I see at the shows. I love you so much more than I'll ever be able to say to you. Thank you so much.
I also think One of the sweetest acceptance speeches of the evening came from Meghan Trainor when she won for her song All About That Bass.
No, my mom and I looked at each other and she held my hand because I was like, it's okay, mom, I'm not going to get these. And she was like, it's okay if you don't get them. And then literally they said All About That Bass. And I was like, we looked at each other like, what? Oh, gosh, I have to go up there now. And then the crowd was so loud, I couldn't even speak. It was amazing. I don't even know how to explain it.
It was pretty cool. Meghan did well. Swift took home the most trophies, followed by Sam Smith, Iggy Azalea, and Pharrell, who each won 3 awards. Sam Smith took home the coveted Top New Artist. Iggy Azalea won the Top Rap Artist and Top Rap Song for Fancy, beating out Nicki Minaj in both categories. Scandal. And Pharrell won Top R&B Song for Happy, no surprise there. But he beat out Beyonce for Top R&B Album and Artist of the Year. So I know, kind of scandalous too. I don't know if the Beehive would really appreciate that. But
like that bass song though. That's
I like it too.
Tell me about this. How was Kanye West? You know, he's gotten into some trouble in the past.
Kanye West. Now, I think he was really like the biggest loser of the evening because his performance was a mess. I'll tell you why. He closed out the show, but because there was so much profanity in his performance, they had to bleep out like at least a minute of it. And then on top of that, the pyrotechnics were so intense and overwhelming, we couldn't see him. So as watching the awards from someone on television, you know, for someone who's watching from the television, we couldn't see him. And we couldn't hear him. So it was really a fiasco. It was kind of comical, but not in a good sense.
Well, you know, you would have thought he would have thought about that bleeping bit part. But how was a tribute to B.B. King? I mean, that's a sad story there.
Well, you know, B.B. King, the Billboard Awards last night positioned itself as a night of historic first and memorable moments. So like Iggy Azalea and Britney Spears performing their song Pretty Girls for the first time on stage, the first time Mariah Carey sang on the Billboard Awards in 7 years. So in light of following through on that promise, the tribute to B.B. King was really shallow and disappointing. It was a quick paragraph, a picture, and a shot of a guitar sitting on
the
stage.
Maybe they'll do something more on another occasion, you know?
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Nikki, for stopping by. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure being here.
Okay, that's Nikki Strong with the VOA Music Division.
And we award you the best listener in the world. Thanks for joining us for International Edition here on The Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned about the treatment of political prisoners in Belarus. On May 4th, former presidential candidate Nikolai Statkevich was sentenced to harsher prison conditions and increased security measures for alleged violations of prison rules. Mr. Statkevich is serving a 6-year sentence related to his participation in peaceful protests following the December 2010 presidential elections. The United States is also concerned by the April 30th denial of Mikolai Ziadok's appeal of a February court decision that extended his prison term by 1 year for alleged prison rules violations. Mr. Ziadok was scheduled to be released in March 2015. In response to international pressure, President Alexander Lukashenko's government has released some political prisoners. For example, between January and September 2011, and again in August and September 2012, Belarusian authorities released, pardoned, or reclassified the offenses as less serious for several of the detainees facing riot charges from events following the December 2010 election. According to the Department of State's annual country reports on human rights practices and non-governmental organization reports, many of them had to admit guilt as a condition of their release. In April 2012, Belarusian authorities released former opposition presidential candidate Andrei Sannikau and his aide, convicted in connection with the peaceful protests in 2010. But according to the State Department and NGO reports, once released, such individuals remain subject to police supervision, and their civil and political rights are not fully restored. Some have also been forbidden, without explanation, from leaving Belarus. The United States renews its call on the government of Belarus to release all political prisoners immediately and unconditionally, and to restore fully their political and civil rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA editorial.